for argument in two workers' compensation cases. The first one is Benchmark Elite versus Simpson, and the second one is Colorado Springs versus Bennett. We have given the Assistant Attorney General 5 minutes at the beginning of each argument to make a statement. So, Attorney General, are we here? You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Katie Allison, attorney registration number 39430, appearing on behalf of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. I am arguing 5 minutes in the beginning of the Simpson case and 5 minutes in the beginning of the Bennett case. These are both in front of you on the same issue, and while I will briefly outline factual differences, my arguments in the two cases is the same. Your Honors, these two cases are a direct consequence of your ruling in Avalanche Industries versus Clark. And the present interpretation we have of the Avalanche decision is problematic. First, the panel, as the first level of review in workers' compensation cases, believes that the new definition of the date of injury in Part C of the Avalanche decision is unworkable. Second, this new definition will potentially produce unintended results. The Simpson case is an example. I will address three different aspects of Part C of the Avalanche decision. First, the impact of redefining the date of injury. Second, the date of disablement. And third, disablement as a second injury. Before I jump in, I'd like to highlight a few facts of the Simpson case, which I'm sure the parties will expand upon. It's a workers' compensation case in which Mr. Simpson suffered an admitted work-related injury on April 25, 2000. He was never able to return to work. This condition worsened on May 5, 2004, and the claim was reopened. The insurer eventually admitted for permanent total disability benefits. And really what we are talking about is the application of these facts to Avalanche. The Court of Appeals interpreted Part C of Avalanche to say that there's always a date of injury and the date of disablement, though these two dates may coincide. The date of injury includes the time of disablement, and the date of disablement may be considered a second injury. First, redefining the date of injury. Your Honors, if there is a central premise, a central axiom in comp law, it is the date of injury. Administration of the act is wholly dependent on this date. It is the fundamental timeline. It is the date upon which the rights and liabilities of the parties is premised. In addition, reopening an award, lump sum awards, the amount of awards, these are all dependent upon the statute in effect at the time of the claimant's injury. Redefining this date has a great impact on the way the act is administered. It is no coincidence that there are two cases before you, not 16 months after your decision in Avalanche. And these are not highly unusual comp cases. The panel is seeing the same influx of cases, and truly, Your Honors, the panel just wants to be able to apply workers' compensation cases consistently. According to Part C of Avalanche, the date of injury includes the time of disablement. Now, where the Workers' Compensation Act does not mention disablement. Until Avalanche, the date of injury did not include the date of disablement. So what is disablement? The cases before the court show that even the Court of Appeals is unsure of how to determine when this date is. In the Simpson case, we know the date of the precipitating accident. We know the date the claimant could no longer work. We know the two dates the claimant reached maximum medical improvement. We know the dates of the final admissions of liability and the dates the claimant went from temporary total disability to permanent partial disability to permanent total disability. Even with these undisputed dates, the Court of Appeals was not prepared to determine when disablement occurred, and it remanded to the ALJ. The ALJ does not have further guidance. It seems that the Avalanche decision hinted that the date of disablement might be the date that the claimant can no longer work. But I think this just invites a cascade of new questions. Who determines the date the claimant can no longer work? Is it the claimant, the claimant's attorney, the claimant's physician? Can the insurer dispute that determination? What if the claimant had to stop working because he aggravated his work injury in a non-work-related incident? When is that claimant's date of disablement? The problem with having the date of injury include the time of disablement is that no matter how it is defined, disablement is fully subjective. It is ripe for abuse. It encourages claimants to slow the process down so they can get, for example, a higher average weekly wage. On the contrary,
your time has expired.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
The petitioner? I'm sorry, I forgot to advise counsel that that Justice Hobbs will be participating in this in these cases. He was unable to be here this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Thomas Canaan. I work for the law firm of Lee and Kinder. I'd like to introduce my opponent. Attorney is Chris Forsyth for the claimant. And also here in the courtroom today is Jeff Erickson, who helped me on the briefs in the Court of Appeals, and Kristen Caruso, who helped on the brief here in the Supreme Court. The issue that the court granted certiorari on is relatively simple, it seems like. It did the Court of Appeals err in remanding this claim to the administrative law judge for determination of the time of disablement for the injured worker for purposes of setting the applicable statutory limit on his benefits. The premise of the Court of Appeals in the underlying Simpson case is that a single workers' compensation case can involve multiple dates of injury for purposes of recalculating the limits on payment of indemnity benefits. There would be no fixed maximum limit linked to the date of injury as derived from the avalanche case. We presented a relatively simple argument in our brief. The basic argument is in two parts. The first part is that the statutory maximum in effect as of the time of the claimant's compensable injury applies to his claim thereafter. This argument is completely supported by Part A, the analysis discussion in the avalanche case, which focuses in on limits on the discretion of an administrative law judge in determining the underlying average weekly wage issue. The court specifically says that the limit of the state maximum average weekly wage applies to a claim to limit the discretion of an administrative law judge in determining an average weekly wage in a case. What's happened in the Simpson case, unlike the Clark case or the Avalanche Industries case, was that Ms. Clark was working and not earning at the maximum amount. She never reached the maximum, even with the adjustment in average weekly wage that the court found in the Avalanche Industries case. We argued at that time, and we meaning, I guess I did myself, that the discretion the court was willing to give the administrative law judge would be virtually unlimited. And the court emphasized that this discretion is not going to be unlimited because there are ways in which a claim can be predictable in the payment of the maximum amounts that can be paid to an injured worker, that there are limits on how a case can be reopened. And there are ways in which the law limits the ultimate maximum amounts that can be paid. Under this theory, the employer's liabilities accrue at the time of the disability for which compensation is sought. The liabilities are determined by the law in effect at the time of the compensable injury itself, when it manifests itself. The employee's liabilities are determined by the substantive law in effect as of the date of the injury. We believe that this is completely consistent with Colorado law. The law has always looked back to an original date of injury. Under the definitional section of wages, they talk about the contract of hire that was in effect at the time of the injury. And so there wouldn't be any effect on the ultimate maximum because subsequent injuries that are compensable within a workers' compensation claim uniformly have been related back to the original injury date as the date of the accident. The alternative argument we made in our brief is that even if Part C is good law, as stated, The claimant never earned anything following his injury, so there's literally no subsequent earnings established to support any modification in his average weekly wage or any modification in the amount of money he would earn for purposes of an award of additional benefits. And we're relying on the specific language of Section 842.104 sub 1, which is quoted with approval in Part C of the Avalanche Industries opinion. Now, in our second argument, we are assuming that somehow a second injury can occur for the same claim that does not relate back to the original injury for determination of compensability of the subsequent injury. We don't believe that's the law, but that's what we're assuming in this second argument. And let me just comment on what the law has been. There are a number of ways in which a claimant can suffer a subsequent injury. One way is a direct and natural progression of the injury or deterioration of the underlying condition. The basic injury has stayed what it was, but over time, the consequences, the symptoms, and the limitations become worse. So this is a progress or a deterioration. There also can be a consequential accident. For instance, I suffer some dizziness because of a head injury. I'm working at a lathe and I cut a finger off because of my dizziness. That consequential accident is a new injury. It could support a new injury claim. It also could be presented by a worker as relating back to the dizziness caused by the original injury. But it could support two claims. But it depends on the option of the worker and how he wants to pursue them. There can be a temporary exacerbation claim. Those are the kind of cases where a claimant has a temporary effect from a new accident that was consequentially caused by the underlying incident, but there's no permanent effect. So there's a temporary period of time in which a person is limited and can apply for indemnity benefits, but it relates back to the original injury. And then one type of injury that frequently is seen is a quasi-course and scope injury. And this would be an injury where a person maybe is getting medical benefits on the way to the doctor's office, they're in an automobile accident, and by a legal fiction, the workplace is extended to include that accident as if it had happened at the place of employment. That's a legal fiction. But that also, as a matter of timing, relates back the underlying industrial injury. The additional argument we have made as a part of assuming that Part C applies is that we believe it is absurd to force a claimant to get $0 when he's already been determined to be permanently and totally disabled. So by a literal reading of Part C of the Avalanche Injuries Opinion and applying literally Section 842.104 sub 1, the claimant should get $0. And finally, it ignores the fact, at least as I interpret it, Section 842.104 sub 1 actually refers to multiple but separately compensable claims. I think that's an important point to make because the court in Avalanche put a very technical reading on the word injury in order to come up with a new interpretation that had never been applied within the workers' compensation system. Section 842.104 applies to previous injury or compensation and the effect of that. So the fact that an employee has suffered a previous disability or impairment or received compensation, therefore, shall not preclude compensation for a later injury or for death. And it's our understanding, that's my argument, that later injury refers to a distinct new injury that would support a new claim of compensation. That's the very thing that the statute is regulating. It says you can have a new injury claim supporting a new claim for compensation, even though there's been an underlying injury to the same part of the body for a previous disability. And it also includes claims for death. Those, by definition, can only happen once, and they are not identical with the underlying industrial injury. By law, a death claim is a separate new injury. It is never the same injury as the underlying workers' compensation claim. So that has to contemplate two separate claims. The part of Section 842.104 that is actually cited in the Avalanche case only refers to the language of determining compensation benefits payable for the later injury or death, and it seems to interpret a later injury as supporting a new injury incident within the same claim. So those are matters that are addressed in our brief. I want to go on a bit, and I guess I'll apologize initially for any tone of disgruntlement that may enter into my remarks, because I was a losing attorney in the Avalanche Industries case, and Part C was, at least from a lawyer's perspective, somewhat galling. Part of the problem that I would argue matters is there was nothing suggested, argued, briefed, are included in the case as presented to this court by the parties that supported the discussion in Part C of that opinion. That was not a part of that case. It just came out of the blue to the parties. It is not described in the opinion as dicta, but it's not based on a developed record. The ALJ in the underlying case made no findings whatsoever on a subsequent disabling injury. No discussion on disablement. The ALJ decision below solely was based on the discretionary provision of Section 842.102 sub 3. There were no facts and no facts found to support a conclusion of law in Part C. There weren't any facts discussed in that opinion to say why there would have been a subsequent injury that would have led to the same results under the default provision of the average weekly wage statute. As I previously argued, Section 842.104 sub 1 actually concerns subsequent separate compensable injuries that could be with the same employer or they could be with a different employer. And I would refer you to the Platte Valley Lumber case if you want to see a case that discusses how that statute works in practice. The definition of wages section that's incorporated in Section 842.102 sub 2, the default provision as discussed in Avalanche, still, we argue, incorporates the general definitional language of Section 840.201 sub 2, and there's no other context, unlike the discretionary provision, no other context in which to look at this general definition. And the general definition says it applies to the contract of hire in force at the time of the injury. That has to be the original injury. So that, and that reopening based on works on a worsening does not necessarily mean a new injury to the injured worker. It can mean a deterioration of the underlying condition. And finally, before I save a little time, in the Clark case itself, the litigation that had occurred on reopening actually involved independent subsequent injuries alleged by respondents as barring the reopening because a new injury was responsible for this worker's disability. What the judge found was, those new injuries were not significant. What was significant was the deterioration of her underlying condition. So if there was an injury, it was that kind of injury that was in the Clark case. But I would also note, and maybe I should say that this is hypothetical, because that was not a part of the record on appeal. So thank you very much, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes and 38 seconds. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Forsyth, registration number 22608, here on behalf of respondent Richard Simpson. We're here today regarding the maximum benefit statute. We've heard oral arguments so far sort of relitigating the Avalanche case. We do not agree with that phrasing of the issue here. The court phrased the issue as for the purpose of setting the applicable statutory limit on claimants' workers' compensation benefits. That brings into play the maximum benefit statute, which I haven't heard any oral argument regarding the maximum benefit statute thus far. There is no dispute in this case regarding the average weekly wage that was in effect on the date of the injury. The average weekly wage was $1,050. That corresponds to a permanent total disability rate, or temporary total disability rate, of $700. So Mr. Simpson's actual 66 2/3% of his average weekly wage was $700. Is he getting paid at that rate today? No, he has not. Has he ever been paid at that rate? No, he has not. Why? Because The insurance company in this case has applied the maximum benefit rate that was in effect on the date of the injury in this case and never paid him more than that. In other words, he is subject to the rate that was in effect prior to July 1st, 2000. That rate was $559.23. Avalanche does come into play in this case a little bit. And why is that? In Avalanche, the court looked at the different sections of the average weekly wage statute. And the court declined to read into the discretionary exception of the average weekly wage statute the phrase at the time of the injury, because the phrase was not in there. Likewise, that phrase is not contained in the maximum benefit statute. The maximum benefit statute states that it is applicable to the ensuing 12 months beginning July 1st, and it's recalculated annually. So to be consistent with Avalanche, it would be appropriate for this court to read the state average weekly wage as not containing the phrase at the time of the injury, because it doesn't, just like the discretionary exception in the Avalanche case did not contain the phrase. It must be noted, I've heard the disgruntlement over the Avalanche case. I read that holding as quite open as simply saying the ALJ has discretion to determine the average weekly wage, and he's not stuck to at the time of the injury under the discretionary provision. That's the holding of Avalanche. Here, the state average weekly wage issue, it's a separate issue because we have no dispute regarding average weekly wage number one. But number two, to be consistent with Avalanche, the court should refuse to read at the time of the injury into the state average weekly wage statute as it did in Avalanche. There is an interesting issue that the Court of Appeals raised, whether the rate, the maximum benefit rate, stays the same, automatically changes, or whether it's appropriate for an ALJ to rule that the maximum benefit rate at issue on the date of his ruling is appropriate to apply. There's different levels. Because the statute contains the word automatically, we argue that the rate changes automatically. In other words, in Mr. Simpson's case, what should have happened is that each year that on July 1st, his benefits are not recalculated. No other claimant's benefits are recalculated. The director sets one rate based on his calculation of the state average weekly wage. At that point in time, because he was subject to the maximum, what should have occurred is the adjuster in the case should have looked at the state maximum and simply raised his rate to that rate for the next 12 months, as the statute says, and continued to do so until he reached his actual 66 2/3% of his average weekly wage, which is $700, which he would have, by today's date, he would receive that amount because it has increased at this point to over $700. So based on the actual wording of the statute, the plain language, which is what the court is to go by, it says that the state average weekly wage shall automatically form the basis for establishing maximum benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act. So we are urging a plain language reading of the state average weekly wage statute, which says it applies, is applicable to the ensuing 12 months and automatically forms the basis for wages paid. If for some reason the court does not agree that the rate automatically changes, in this case that's really not what occurred, because we objected to a final admission of liability and set the matter for hearing. At the hearing, the judge ruled that he did not have discretion. He was jurisdictionally barred. He said he could not exceed the rate of $559.23, which was the rate that was no longer in effect at that time. It was the rate that was in effect back in April 24th, 2000. So the question is, did the ALJ correctly ascertain that he had no jurisdiction to go beyond that amount? There is nothing in the statute that prohibits an ALJ from providing a maximum benefit rate that's in effect at the time he issued this order. In other words, in 2006, he could have said, Mr. Simpson, the current maximum benefit rate is $697.20. That is the maximum benefit rate I must apply to your injury at this time. There's nothing in the statutes that prevents him from doing that.
Mr. Forsythe, may I interrupt one second? I'm having a little trouble following the argument you're making now and how that affects the Court of Appeals' order to remand to determine the time of disablement.
The question is, was whether the Court of Appeals erred in remanding it for determining. This, as you know, we presented alternate arguments in our brief. The brief, this argument goes to, the Court of Appeals did not err in remanding it, but yes, the Court of Appeals erred in remanding it to a determination of the time of disablement, because the time of disablement is attached to the phrase at the time of the injury. That's in Avalanche, that's where it left out, was at the phrase at the time of the injury. Is that phrase in the statute that sets the applicable statutory limit on claimants' workers' compensation benefits? No, it is not.
So you're not defending the Court of Appeals order here. You're saying it should be remanded, but for a different reason from what the Court of Appeals
said. It's three separate arguments. First argument is no, it should not be remanded. You should rule as a matter of law that the applicable statutory rate changed each year automatically, and that the insurance company should admit for those rates. So the first argument is no remand, rule of law, these are the rates in effect each year, they only apply for 12 months. Okay, that's argument number one. Argument number two is, yes, it was appropriate to remand, but the remand should not be limited to the time of disablement, because the phrase at the time of injury is not in the statute. In other words, there's nothing prohibiting the ALJ from using, if it doesn't automatically change, there's nothing prohibiting the ALJ from using his discretion, which was the main issue in Avalanche, from applying the maximum benefit rate that's in effect as the day he issues his order. And our third argument was, well, yes, it's appropriate to remand for the time of disablement. The problem with this case, as counsel has pointed out, is that they have an argument. Again, there's not sufficient facts in the record because this issue was not presented at hearing. But they have an argument, should it go back, that if you pick a different date of disablement, could they argue that his wage was zero? They agree in the briefs that this is absurd. Could they argue it? Well, technically, yes. So that forced us to look at this issue and realize this isn't an average weekly wage issue. When you look at an average weekly wage issue, is there a wage loss as a result of the work injury? Absolutely yes in this case. He's permanently totally disabled. He got a 40% impairment rating. This guy cannot work and never has been able to. The interesting place their argument takes you, if we go back to the ALJ, on the issue of date of disablement, the ALJ could determine that Mr. Simpson was permanently totally disabled as of the date of the injury, because based on their argument, he can't work. Well, he hasn't been able to work since the original date of injury. So their argument would have you going back and getting a permanent total disability date that's not related to the date of maximum medical improvement, but is related to when he couldn't work, and he couldn't work from the original date of injury. So even if they argue that, we have a couple-year window in there where he did not receive any wages that they would owe him for. So there would still be an increase of benefits to Mr. Simpson under their argument, because he was not paid any benefits from a period in 2001 to a period in 2004. So if you logically follow that argument, if he's not disabled, he was always disabled because he wasn't working, and therefore it has to apply to the MMI date, and he wasn't earning wages on that date, I would counter and say no. If you're using that argument, the logical rationale is to take it all the way back to when he stopped working, which was the date of the injury. And I fail to see how the ALJ should be barred from using his discretion to say that the date of disablement was the originating date of injury, therefore benefits had to be paid from that time period ongoing. So that would be the issue if we go back. Again, our preferred construction is an argument against the Court of Appeals, saying that the remand is improper because as a matter of law, the maximum benefit statute does not contain the phrase "at the time of the injury." The reason that this argument is so important to Mr. Simpson and any other workers' compensation claimant, you can look at by looking at his rate. He's getting, his rate is based off a rate of $559.23. That's only 53% of his average weekly wage, when all other wage earners are getting 66 2/3% of their average weekly wage. So we're giving him quite a bit less, and we've left him bound by that rate, when is an avalanche, we can see if somebody's not injured that seriously on the date of injury, has subsequent employment, they can raise their rate and get compensated pursuant to that higher rate, whereas Mr. Simpson is left hanging at his 53% of his average weekly wage. That's not a harmonious construction of the Workers' Compensation Act. I fail to see how anybody could argue that that's a harmonious construction of the Workers' Compensation Act. This man was seriously injured in an automobile accident on April 24th, 2000. He's been unable to work since then. There's nothing in the Workers' Compensation Act that says he is bound by the maximum benefit rate on that date of injury. Nothing. At the time of injury is not in the state average weekly wage statute. We are not asking for an increase. The Belinder v. Kazir case has been mentioned in the briefs. This case is completely different from Belinder v. Kazir. In that case, the claimant was requesting a cost of living increase that wasn't present in statute. She was saying the absence of a statute providing a cost of living increase is unconstitutional. Okay? This is a, and furthermore, she did not receive a wage in excess of the maximum benefit rate. It wasn't a maximum benefit rate statute at issue in that case. And that case specifically said that we're not determining maximum benefits. Here, we have a gentleman who, on the date of the injury, earned enough to get him to the maximum benefit statute. So the controversy in Avalanche, where the person didn't earn the wages at the time of the injury, is not present in this case. Mr. Simpson earned enough money at the time of the injury to support a higher rate than he is being paid. And they have wanted to increase, keep this reduction in effect forever because it saves the insurance company money. That's not fair or equitable to Mr. Simpson, and it is not harmonious under the Workers' Compensation Act. Even under our interpretation, the insurance company has a cost of savings benefit because they have a maximum benefit that they know will not be, they will never have to pay more than the maximum benefit statute provides. In this case, there's certainty because they know that his PTD rate is $700. They can calculate the cost savings they get by the maximum benefit rate statute because they know they won't have to pay the $700 rate for many years. So this is a cost saving statute for the benefit of the insurance company, and it still provides cost savings benefit under our argument. The problem is Mr. Simpson should not be denied 66 2/3 of his average weekly wage forever because the statutes never say he should be. The maximum benefit rate at this point in time is at such a level that he would get a full 66 2/3, his $700 rate. We're simply here requesting that the court make that so. Thank you.
May it please the court. I think the gist of the claimant's argument in this case is that an issue that was not accepted for certiorari review by this court should be the one that determines the outcome. His argument does, though, point out the problem of looking at a floating date of injury and how that can affect an uncertainty with the role of the maximum rate of payment of indemnity benefits under the Act. Just to refer to Section 847.106, what it says is that the state average weekly wage shall automatically form the basis for establishing maximum benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act of Colorado as of 12:01 a.m. July 1, 1974, and each succeeding time and date annually thereafter. It's very clear in establishing maximum benefits. And it follows the law that is well-known, that rights and liabilities of parties in workers' compensation claims are governed by the substantive law in effect on the date of the injury. The date of the injury is the date in which the injury occurs. Now, there is sometimes a discrepancy between a date when an accident may have happened or an exposure to an injurious substance may have happened and disablement. That is not an infrequent occurrence. And in fact, under the Workers' Compensation Act, the claim is not compensable for purposes of disability benefits unless the claimant has lost more than 3 days of work. So there can be a 3-day period where you've had an injury accident, but where you're not eligible for benefits. If you have become disabled for 3 days, then you are eligible for benefits. And that can occur after the time of the accident. So there can be a lag, but it's still the date of the injury and the injury accident that supports the time when you were under a contract of hire for determining average weekly wage in the ordinary case.
Mr. Canan, I understood Mr. Forsythe to say that his client has not been paid anything for the first 2 years after his car accident. Is that correct?
I don't know, Your Honor. As far as I know, he was receiving disability benefits going back to the date of accident. But I will say this, that we were not the SIGA, the Colorado Insurance Guarantee Association, was not on the risk at that time. That was at a time when I believe it was Fremont Insurance was on the risk. The SIGA takes over a claim after the underlying insurer becomes insolvent. I don't actually know, Your Honor. But my time is up. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all of you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and